How will we power our future? Can we create a healthy and clean economy? Climate One at the Commonwealth Club is at the forefront of the global debate about energy, economy, and the environment. Bringing together the brightest and most provocative leaders of our time, Climate One is the place where big ideas get heard. With thoughtful and insightful discussions on policy, business, science, and culture, Climate One founder Greg Dalton gets to the heart of the matter. It's our future. It's time to come together.
The number of automobiles in the world is forecast to surge from about 800 million today to somewhere between 2 and 4 billion over the next 40 years. To some, that presents a huge business opportunity and increased individual freedom. Others see gridlock, social stress, and environmental disasters. With growing ranks of middle-class consumers in China, India, Brazil, and other emerging economies, what is the future of the automobile? Can personal mobility be decoupled from the burning of fossil fuels that is destabilizing the Earth's ability to support life as we know it? Can American auto companies keep up with their international competitors? I'm Greg Dalton, host of Climate One, the sustainability initiative here at the Commonwealth Club. And over the next hour, we'll discuss cars, fuels, and technology with our live audience at the Commonwealth Club. Our guest is an icon of the global auto industry. William Clay Ford Jr. was CEO of Ford Motor Company from 2000 to 2006, and today serves as executive chairman of Ford, which is the 25th largest company in the world. Please welcome Mr. Ford to Climate One. Thank you for coming.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's begin with it. You wrote a letter on sustainability in June of this year, and you talked about the future of automobiles in a world where there's going to be 2 or 4 billion automobiles, and you talked about urbanization and a more holistic view of transportation. What's your vision for that?
Well, it's interesting. When people think about the auto industry and they think about the environment, most everybody's been focused on CO2 and fossil fuels and the effect that that has both on us politically and also environmentally. And that's absolutely an appropriate focus. But I started to realize there's this other looming issue that was lurking out there that nobody was focused on, and that's what I started calling global gridlock. Because if you just do the math and you just did some of it, in our lifetime, the world's going to go from about 7 billion people to about 9 billion people. While that's happening, the number of cars is going to go from just under a billion today to, as you said, two to four billion. There's another phenomenon that's happening at the same time, which is people are increasingly moving to cities. So you're going to have 75% of those 9 billion people living in urban areas. And how are they going to move? It's a huge issue, and it's an issue today. Mostly outside of the U.S., although I suppose if you're in Los Angeles and other places, you'd say it's already here today, but certainly not to the extent that it is in many parts of the world, particularly Asia. I mean, you may have seen last summer they had an 11-day traffic jam in China, which is, incredible. And yet it's only the tip of the iceberg. So how is the world going to address this issue, and how are we as mobility providers going to provide solutions and not be part of the problem? And so I'm not trying to turn attention from CO2 and fuel economy, but I think we're on a good road there. I mean, we've got a lot of battles ahead of us and a long way to go, but I can see a game plan to get us to an environmental answer that people are going to be happy with and that I'm going to be happy with. But put another way, even if we clean up our cars, 4 billion clean cars is still 4 billion cars. And so we need to solve that problem. And if I could take just a second, I don't want to be too long-winded, but just to say a couple of things that we're doing in that regard.
Sure.
Because I think it's interesting. Technology is really going to be what sets us free. And a lot of that technology is being developed here in California, particularly Silicon Valley. We at Ford we just put out a fleet of demonstrator vehicles with vehicle-to-vehicle technology. What that basically does is if your car is 5 miles ahead of mine in traffic and you hit a traffic jam, it'll tell my car immediately, well, it'll tell all the cars around it immediately, and then the car can automatically reroute itself. We just introduced a concept car called Evos, which is connected to the cloud, which can not only it can check your blood sugar and your blood pressure and all those things, But it can also anticipate what's ahead. So if and it can change your car. So for instance, if you're in nice weather, but 2 miles ahead it's raining, your car will know that, and it'll start to adjust the suspension, the steering, and the vehicle dynamics so that you'll be, you know, well prepared. Your car will be well prepared when you hit that. That's all ready for prime time, that kind of stuff. A little bit further ahead, though, is vehicle to infrastructure communication, so that if you think about traffic jams, you can your vehicle will be able to talk to all the intersections so the traffic lights can be timed in real time. If you today, 30% of all fuel burned in major cities is burned looking for a parking spot. It's an incredible number, but it's a true number.
We know that in San Francisco for sure.
Well, it's true. Yeah, I mean, you do, and you know it in other cities. So now, what if your car can, when you leave home, pre-reserve you a parking spot, know exactly where that spot is, and you drive right to it and get out? That will be a huge help for global congestion. And these are all technologies we know about today, but there's going to be a tremendous surge of innovation that's going to help deliver this, but it's going to actually require something beyond technology. It's going to require a level of coordination that we've never seen before. Coordination not just between cars talking to each other, but every form of transport, trains, buses, subways, cars, segways, bicycles. It's all going to have to be one interconnected network. It's going to have to be a network where, in some cases, one ticket will get you everything. And I know you've got some of that here already in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. But again, that's going to have to become much more sophisticated. But really, it's going to require all the different forms of transport to work together in an urban environment to make it all work. Cars will be a piece of that puzzle, but we won't be the only piece.
And one piece of the car puzzle is mobility as a service. I know you've talked about Zipcar and whether Zipcar, car sharing, is that a threat to automakers or is that an opportunity?
Well, I think it's a great opportunity. I don't know how other automakers are doing it, but it's funny. You know, when I met you at that same event,
yeah,
was Scott Griffith, the CEO of Zipcar. And I heard what he was saying, and I thought, this is really cool. So I got to know him. In fact, I went out that night, and we hung out together that night. And I was really excited by the business model, and I thought, this is really interesting. So we just announced, I don't know, a month ago, I think, a partnership with Zipcar that we're going to provide on 253 college campuses. Ford and Zipcar are partnering across the country. So I think it's a really great opportunity, and it's a really good thing, again, for urban mobility, because people don't have to own cars. They want to have access to cars. And so the Zipcar model, I think, is a great one.
And you don't see that as a threat that, well, you're going to sell fewer cars because people don't, they rent, they don't buy.
Look, it's going to happen anyway, whether we like it or not. And so so we might as well like it.
there's one interesting here in San Francisco called Relay Rides, which is a different model where individuals, think about a car, you buy it and it sits there idle, depreciating, you're paying insurance, it's not used 80% of the time, you can rent it out and get some revenue off your idle car. Pretty cool.
I'm familiar with it. It's very cool. And I think all these new applications for transportation are all going to be needed. And they're all. And I think if we're talking 5 years from now, we're going to be talking about stuff that we haven't even begun to think about. But I do believe that technology is really going to be sort of the great liberator in all this. I've outlined what some of those technologies are. But the rate of change in technology is quite staggering. And just the notion of bringing the cloud into the vehicle, there are issues with that. There are privacy issues and things that still need to be worked out. But on the other hand, it can be really, really powerful.
And how about young consumers? I mean, some of these things, car sharing comes natural to college campuses,
sure,
et cetera. How do you think young consumers, I mean, they used to be, a car was a tool of social mobility. Now, if you ask people if they give up their car or their cell phone, they might give up their car and keep their cell phone.
Look, I think there's this whole model called collaborative consumption that's out there in the next generation, and cars will be part of that. And so and I think that's something that the next generation is very comfortable with. And the cell phone and the iPad and the computer are all now seamless with the car. I mean, your car can, in this demo vehicle that we've built called Evos, I mean, it's connected to your calendar. So your car will actually, you know if your meeting's running on time that you're going to, and whether it's, I mean, it's quite remarkable when you start to bring the cloud into the vehicle. We have to do it in a very thoughtful way, though, because, you can overload drivers. Obviously, that's not a good thing for driver distraction. You can give people too much information. So, but the point is, there's no limit to what can be done. And I think it's then up to us and customers to do it in a very thoughtful way.
Another thing coming into the car is electricity. You have said that about by 2020, a quarter of the cars you sell will be electric. How are you going to get there?
That's a really good guess, by the way. I have no idea what that
is. No one really.
Sounds good. No one knows. Well, I see, that's the thing. Nobody. I mean, I learned long ago that predictions in our industry usually don't pan out. But I will say this. We are making big bets on electric. And, in fact, we have an all-electric Focus still coming this year. We have a plug-in coming next year. We're actually choosing to do something a little different, though, with our electric vehicles. A lot of our competitors, or some of them anyway, are doing purpose-built vehicles. We actually decided to electrify a mainstream product called the Focus. And the reason we did that is, Ford's history, my great-grandfather believed in creating transportation for the average person and not to make it kind of an elitist thing. And so we felt that by electrifying a mainstream product like the Focus and making it affordable and also making it flexible, so because coming down the same line will be an internal combustion 40-mile-per-gallon Focus, pure electric Focus, a hybrid off of the Focus platform, and a plug-in off the and that way the customer decides, which one do I like best? And whichever way they decide, we can flex up and meet that demand.
So General Motors and Nissan have been first to the market with pure electrics. You're
right.
A little bit later, but you think you have a more flexible strategy.
Well, I mean, I like our strategy because it really lets the market decide how it all rolls out and what the customer wants. Because right now, one size doesn't fit all. And I think that's really because of batteries. I mean, you still have range limitations on pure electric. And now, we're rolling out our pure electric. And I think that that has application for certain, for instance, if you live in San Francisco and all you do is drive in the city, that's great. Pure electric is probably exactly what you want. But now, if you have that same vehicle, but you want to drive to Los Angeles on the weekend, now you want to plug in because you drive all week on the battery. But you have the freedom then of the gasoline backup engine to go, wherever you'd like to go. That distinction will start to narrow as batteries get better and range starts to extend on the pure electrics. And like all new technologies, expect that to happen. But as we sit here today, you really do have some range issues on pure electric, which then are, ameliorated when you go to a plug-in or obviously a conventional hybrid.
Nissan made a big splash when they priced the Leaf very aggressively. The Volt, some people say it's very high, around 40. Have you decided on a price for the Focus?
We haven't announced it, but it's obviously going to be very competitive because, as I said a minute ago, we want to make it affordable to lots of people. And so, I mean, that's our goal on all our technology. It's interesting. We made a very audacious bet about 4 years ago. We decided we wanted to be the fuel economy leader in every single segment. And coming from us and our background, that wasn't certainly our strength. And it's certainly not what people would have expected from us.
The maker of the Explorer.
Well, yeah, in the F-150. But we decided even in the F-150, we wanted to be the fuel economy leaders. So we rolled out a technology. And so one of the things that enabled that was during the dark days of our industry, during the 2006, 7, 8, 9 period, when a lot of our competitors, not just the domestic, but overseas as well, were cutting back on R&D, and cutting back on product programs, we actually accelerated ours because it seemed to us there's no point in going through a very painful restructuring if you come out at the end of the tunnel and the cupboard's bare. And so we also did some research which showed that the number one reason that people rejected Ford was fuel economy. So we said, okay, let's shoot for the moon here and see if we can actually deliver it. But to deliver it meant lots of new technology, and that's when we decided we had to double down on our product spending and our new technology. So we did that, and today we're in 12 segments. We're the fuel economy leader, and we think that will continue to grow. But it requires a suite of technologies. It's cleaner. You know, we were about to roll out a new three-cylinder gasoline engine. We've got, obviously, hybrids and...
And you're going to put the hybrid in the F-150 truck.
Eventually we might, but it's harder to hybridize even to a bigger vehicle. It just is. I mean, batteries, you know, of that strength still aren't quite ready for prime time. You can make small hybrid improvements. Frankly, you can make bigger improvements by something we call EcoBoost, which basically allows you to get the power of an 8-cylinder, but the fuel economy of a 6-cylinder. And so that's when I said one size doesn't fit all, and that's true of technology. For some segments, it's better to go there. Others, it's better to go electric. You know, others still compressed natural gas. As we start looking out into the bigger vehicles, and we're still working on biofuels and on hydrogen. But it's interesting how things change. If we were talking 2 years ago, we would have been talking about cellulosic ethanol. If we were talking a few years before that, it would have been fuel cells. And today, it's electric. And we are making big bets on electric, but we're still investing in those others because we really don't know how the world's going to break out. And until this nation has an energy policy, which we desperately need, all of this is going to be sub-optimized. Because think about electrification. So how are we going to build out the smart grid that we've been talking about for 5 or 6 years? It hasn't happened yet. How are we going to power this grid? We're going to have to build more plants. How are we going to power those? Are they going to be coal-fired? I hope not. Are they going to be nuclear? Well, that's a national discussion we need to have. Will renewables do it for us? But we need to have a national policy and a way to get there, because otherwise we're going to be there with the hardware, and customers are going to say, yeah. I like the hardware, but I just don't feel comfortable yet because I don't have ubiquity of plugging. So I think that, as a nation, there's some discussions we need to have, and we need to have them pretty quickly.
Are you part of any group in Washington trying to sort of advance that? Because it seems like there's special interest. The coal people protect their thing. The natural gas people have a different view. It's all carved up, and there's no coherent policy.
Well, but that's... I guess I would just say, too bad. We need to get on with it. Yes, we are making our voice heard in Washington.
Do you think that a gasoline tax would be part of that?
I've been pushing for that for the last 10 years.
You're not going to run for elected office anytime
well,
soon.
Well, politically, no. For a lot of reasons.
Economist says it's great, but no politician will touch it.
No politician will touch it. But I'll give you an example of where that works. Obviously, we're a big player in Europe, and but within the last 10 years, the Europeans decided they wanted to come down the CO2 curve, and they said, okay, how are we going to do this? At the time, diesel seemed to be the best option because electric was still far off and other biofuels weren't available. So what happened was the various EU governments, the NGOs, and the automakers all sat around a table. And we said, how can we collectively make this happen? So the automakers said, well, we can make the small diesels, but the customers have to want to buy it. And so what the governments did across Europe, which made a lot of sense, was they gave tremendous tax breaks to diesel, and they taxed the heck out of petrol. So when a customer came into the gas station, it was a no-brainer. I want to buy the diesel. And guess what? It worked. Overnight, almost, the diesel penetration of the auto fleet just went like this, and it's now in every segment it's worked, but unfortunately, without that kind of clear price signal to the customer, it wouldn't have happened that quickly. We don't have that in this country. People often say to me, well, why don't you do diesels? You have them in Europe, you have them in Asia. Yeah, we do, but if you go into a diesels cost slightly more to the customer to buy up front.
Right.
And if you pull into a gas station today, diesel is either priced on or above gasoline. So customers are doing the math and saying this may not be worth the trip.
And there's also health concerns about particulates from
diesel. Yeah, well, that's a whole other thing. But we're solving that in Europe. It's fairly expensive in terms of, the treatment that we have to do. But, for a long time, diesel was sort of a, a word you couldn't use in this country.
It's a dirty word because of the knocking and
exactly. But in Europe, you know, they've embraced it. And I'm not here to shill for diesel at all. In fact, I'm sort of agnostic whether we do diesel or not. But I just point out that was one approach where you had a government that took pricing action to signal a behavior to the customer, and it worked.
Do you think there should be a price on carbon emissions that would give that signal?
Well, you know, we were part of the original part of the Chicago Climate Exchange, which did carbon trading. And I think with any carbon mechanism, it's so complicated. I mean, that's the one thing that and it has to be economy-wide. And so I think a well-thought-out carbon scheme still has yet to be articulated.
If you're just joining us, our guest today at Climate One at the Commonwealth Club is William Clay Ford, Jr., the executive chairman of Ford Motor Company. I'm Greg Dalton. Your bio describes you as a lifelong environmentalist. What do you think about some of the recent attacks on the EPA, clean air, clean water, et cetera, that's happened in Washington?
Well, you know, I mean, we work very well with the government. In fact, you know, the one national standard for CAFE, which is a very tough standard.
The mileage standards.
Yeah, exactly. We worked very closely with the government on that, and it's going to be tough for us to do it, but it's the right thing to do. And so, you know, if I rewind 10 years ago, we basically said no to everything. I mean, our whole goal environmentally was to comply, and not for leadership, but.
And to litigate sometimes and fight California.
But, you know, well, here's the one thing that we couldn't stand as a manufacturer, because we can't have multiple states. That's why we really wanted one national standard. Uh-huh. Because as a manufacturer, if you try and make something for California, something different for Nevada, something different for, I mean, it's an absolute nightmare. So we were happy to have a tough one national standard, because we can comply with that.
Do you think there's a trade-off between environmental standards and jobs, that environmental standards cost jobs?
Well, I mean, I think you could turn it around and say they create jobs, because it's going to require a lot of new technology to meet these standards. And so, you know, we are hiring people who, you know, are well-versed in things like solar, biofuels, electric. And so I think that, you know, anytime you embrace, now, obviously there's a tipping point where if something goes into effect that you simply cannot do, well, then, you know, then that's a problem.
BMW did something recently. Their chairman said they got out of Formula One racing, which has traditionally been used to develop new technologies, and said they're going to put those resources instead into, he would use the word premium, more efficiency and environmental and sustainability initiatives, saying that's where change and innovation will come from. That's pretty interesting. What do you think about saying, not racing, we're going to, rather than have these fuel-guzzling, high-performance cars, we're going to look for another place to innovate?
Well, yeah. I mean, great. I mean, we're doing that, too. And I think, you know, Formula One, you know, we haven't been in that for quite a while. And I don't know that we ever really derived a great benefit technically from it. I mean, our engineers liked working on it years
sure.
ago. I
yeah.
mean, it was fun. I mean, they kind of had a blast working with you know, with race engines. But in really, in terms of what it brought to the mainstream products, it was probably minimal.
One area of innovation, there's a lot of car companies in California that are starting electric. There's Coda, Tesla, Fisker, Better Place. How do you, as based in Detroit with a large incumbent company, look at the innovation that's happening here in California?
I think it's great. I mean, I think that, you know, and it's not just in the electric space. You know, all this technology, information technology, safety technology, it's really pouring now into the auto industry. And I love it. I mean, I'm on the board of eBay, which takes me to the Valley all the time. And when I'm always poking around when I'm there. And in fact, you know, I started my own strategic investment fund in the intelligent transportation space because I saw so much interesting, cool technology being developed in what we call the ITS space that, you know, I really wanted to, you know, personally play in this space. Because I think there's some, if you think about trying, my goal for Ford Motor Company and for my own career is to make people's lives better. And so how do we do that? Well, you know, it used to be that we provided ambulances and fire trucks and police cars and you know, and and really all the way back to my great-grandfather, you know, who, it's interesting, I don't know if you know this, but prior to the Model T, most people never traveled more from further from home in their entire lifetime than 25 miles. That's incredible. And the Model T then changed where people lived, where they worked, and where they played. And so, you know, and also helped create the middle class in the process through the assembly line and all that. So, to me, that's incredibly inspirational. But then how do you translate that into today and tomorrow? And to me, it's solving problems that are facing people. Global gridlock is obviously one of them. When I was younger, you mentioned my environmental interest. You know, it was how do I wake this industry up? Because we were a very insular industry in an insular town that, you know, and there weren't a lot of kindred spirits. And it was, you know, and it was, in fact, I was told to, you know, very early, and this was a direct quote, stop associating with any known or suspected environmentalists.
And card-carrying environmentalists.
Yeah. Exactly. So that was, that was interesting. And then I addressed the Greenpeace International Conference, I think, in 1991. And I'm not sure who was more freaked out by it, the Greenpeace people or the people in Dearborn. So this whole notion of making people's lives better, I think, you know, is what drives me. And it really has to drive, you know, our enterprise. And not everybody's going to have that same resonance with it that works there. But it's why I get up in the morning.
It sounds like the industry's come around to your point of view. Do you feel vindicated that sort of you were out ahead of the industry?
I kind of feel like it's about time.
What took so long?
Well, you know, but a lot of it, too, is technology because, you know, I don't want to keep harping on technology, but if you think of it, it used to be, even 5 years ago, if you wanted an environmentally, good car, there were big trade-offs you had to make to have that. Were you willing to give up space? Were you willing to give up creature comforts like air conditioning? And you know, were you willing to have a three-speed manual transmission? They weren't a lot of fun to drive if you really wanted to have an environmentally correct car. And so a lot of people, you know, if you asked anybody back then, "Are you environmentalist?" Everybody said yes. But then you start saying, what are you willing to give up for it? And, you know, the list starts shrinking pretty rapidly, the people that want us. But technology now has allowed us to have people have those kind of vehicles and still have everything else that they like.
But couldn't the industry have done that sooner if it had invested in those technologies earlier?
I don't think so, because a lot of the technology, you know, came from outside of our arena. And
batteries, for example.
Well, that's obviously very obvious one. It's an interesting question, but on the other hand, a lot of us are trying. And we were developing more fuel-efficient engines, but they weren't a lot of fun to drive. A four-cylinder, in one of our cars was kind of a dog, frankly. But today, the technology is if you drive a four-cylinder, you can actually have a heck of a lot of fun driving that.
There was a fantastic episode on the Jay Leno show 2 years ago where Rush Limbaugh drove, I believe it was a Ford electric car. And if you've seen that, there's a course where he knocks down Al Gore and some other things.
I missed that one.
And Rush Limbaugh, doesn't like Al Gore clearly, but he loved driving the electric car. So it doesn't matter your politics. Driving an electric car is just fun.
Well, they're a blast. It's because there's no accelerator delay. You know, you punch it and you go. It's like a golf cart, basically. You know, except with a lot more behind it. But there's great irony in all this. You know, we spent my entire career trying to figure out how to make cars quieter. Now there's a big debate about how do we add noise back into electric vehicles for pedestrians and everything else. So it makes me kind of smile because we achieved the ultimate. And now we got to dial it back.
You were one of the first companies to bring in an outsider to run an auto company. You brought in Al Mulally from Boeing. Now General Motors has an outsider from telecommunications. How has that changed the industry to have, for the first time, people who didn't come up, lifers running the company?
Well, in Alan's case, it's been fantastic. But it's interesting. What happened when I hired Alan was, I took over in 2001 as CEO, and then we were, awash in red ink, and we got back to 3 years of profitability. But in early 2006, I saw this tidal wave coming at us. The consumer was tapped out. We had way too much capacity as an industry and Ford as well, and I knew a major restructuring was ahead of us. So I did two things. I first went out and borrowed everything we could, and you can imagine that was an interesting family discussion. They said, I said, by the way, we even mortgaged the Blue Oval. They said, you did what?
Heirlooms. Yeah.
But I knew, you know, I needed somebody who had done a major restructuring at a big industrial company to come help lead this. And there were, frankly, it was a pretty short list. But Alan had done that at Boeing because right after 9/11, Boeing's sales dropped 60%. And he had to completely revamp the other thing was, it was amazing the similarities between Boeing and Ford. They had the Toyota production system at Boeing. They had pretty much the same product development system at Boeing that we did. They had pretty much the same supply base management that we did. And really the only difference was they sold their planes to governments and to, you know, big airlines, whereas we sell ours to, you know, to people. But so it was the similarities were striking between Boeing and Ford. And you know, and once I met Alan, I really didn't feel it'd be a stretch at all to bring him on board. But yet, there was a lot of skepticism from the outside. I mean, I'll never forget the first day I introduced Alan to the press. A lot of the longtime automotive press came up to me and said, you guys are never going to make it. You hired this guy, and this is your death knell. And obviously, you know, it turned out that the other guys went bankrupt, and we made it through. So, and Alan's been magnificent. But, you know, and I don't know. Certainly he looked at things with a fresh set of eyes. And probably the biggest thing he did, which I'm not sure an insider would have done, is he looked at all the brands we had. And he said, you've got Jaguar, Aston Martin, Volvo, Land Rover, and Mazda we had a big share of. And how can we make the Ford brand shine when we're distracted by all this other stuff? And I think a lot of us were too close to those brands to maybe have made that decision. So,
well, they were acquired over time, right? So it's hard for people.
They were, and they were great brands, and we were in love with all of them. And you know, and all of them stood for, you know, something that we thought was very interesting and relevant to the customer. And yet, he was absolutely right. For us to make the Ford Oval shine again, we had to focus just on Ford and pour all this technology that we were developing for all these other brands into the Ford brand. And so, and I think that that's a case of a fresh set of eyes and somebody without an emotional attachment coming in and saying, I think this is what we need to do.
If you're just joining us, our guest today is William Clay Ford, Jr., Executive Chairman of Ford Motor Company. I'm Greg Dalton. You mentioned that you got through the financial crisis because of the borrowing. You've had 10 quarters of profits. Standard & Poor's just upgraded Ford's credit rating to near investment grade. You haven't reinstituted a dividend. Do you have any ideas when you'll add a dividend? Or
you sound like a member of my family.
Well, we have a few. Dad, when's that going to start? Yeah.
I have a lot of cousins and relatives that are very interested in that as well.
I'm not acting in their behalf, I promise. But how about the financial outlook for the company?
Well, you know, we've made it through a really tough period, and we've paid down a ton of debt, and we've paid it down much faster than certainly the outsiders, but actually faster than we thought we could too. And so we really feel good about where we are. But, you know, the world is not a happy place right now. You know, as we all know, I mean, it's you know, we've got Europe having real issues, Asia's slowing down. You know, there's big issues in our economy, and so you know, we're very conservative in our planning, and I think it's very appropriate. So we have a very focused plan, and we stay slavish to it, and it's getting us through a very, very tough time. But you know, there's not a lot of blue sky out there. Having said that, we are doing well in a pretty tough time, and we believe we can continue to do well, you know, if we continue to serve the customer and to continue to give them what they value.
Speaking of not a lot of blue sky, there's the Euro crisis, a lot of economic troubles. One way that's manifesting is in the Occupy things, you know, which is directed at corporations partially. How do you view that?
Well, I mean, I certainly understand the the frustration, but I look at it, you know, so what can we do about it? And so one of the things I feel really good about is, you know, we're adding 12,000 jobs in the U.S. Over the next few years, and we're adding blue-collar jobs, we're adding white-collar jobs, and we're actually growing the manufacturing base in North America, and that's something we couldn't have done, you know, 6-7 years ago. But we've restructured our company to add jobs, I'm very proud of that. I'm very proud of the fact that that we are going to be able to offer jobs from, you know, from everything from the kind of technology that we've been talking about, mm-hmm. to assembly line jobs and lots of stuff in between.
Jobs, let's talk about China for a moment. China is a huge potential car market. It's also a competitor in terms of technology innovation. Perhaps will we see Chinese imports into the U.S. like we saw a wave of Japanese imports suddenly?
Well, I'm sure we will at some point, yeah. I mean, I think it's inevitable. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, when I think of our competitors, it's interesting. I was in our corporate strategy office in the early 80s. And there was a prediction then that we boldly, thankfully I didn't author it, but it was, you know, I was too junior, but one of our top people said that within 7 years there would be a maximum of 6 manufacturers globally, and there might only be 3 because there would be tremendous consolidation. Well, in fact, that didn't happen. What happened was quite the obvious. I mean, quite the opposite. We've had a proliferation of competitors. You know, first, obviously, the Japanese, then the Koreans, now the Chinese, and that's just the world we live in. And we have to take on all comers and prove ourselves every day to our customers that we're a company worth them considering. So, yeah, I'm sure we're going to be competing against Chinese and after them, it may be somebody else. I mean, you've got, you know, Russian companies.
Korean Hyundai seems to have come up pretty strong recently.
Hyundai? Absolutely. I mean, Hyundai, Kia. I mean, you know, we play in a tough industry with some great competitors. But, you know, you can't shy away from it. It makes you better as a competitor if you're playing with tough players.
We haven't touched directly on climate change. I want to do that. Before, let's say we're going to put the audience microphone up here and we're going to have some questions for Mr. Ford. So, again, the line will form back there at that door, and we'll put the microphone there. If you're just joining us, our guest today at Climate One at the Commonwealth Club is William Clay Ford, Jr., the executive chairman of Ford Motor Company. I'm Greg Dalton. Let's talk about climate change. There was a story recently that it's kind of, U.S. hasn't done much on that front, where a lot of is happening, you said earlier, Europe earlier. How do you view the climate change debate in the United States, you know, as an executive?
Well, it's kind of like I said about national energy policy. I mean, you know, we need to, there's so many noises that nothing much is happening. I mean, one of the things we've done is we've just taken upon ourselves as a corporate citizen to slash our CO2. We've set tough CO2 targets for ourselves, for our cars, and also for our facilities. We're also focusing on water, which, again, is something that a lot of, you know, people don't really think of water. I mean, I shouldn't say that. I think in the West, you guys do more because water issues are part of everyday life for you. But in parts of the country, it's just not anybody's radar screen. But we set a very tough water usage standard for ourselves. And I think this number is right. Since 2000, we've cut our water usage by about 65%. And we're going to continue on that goal. So whether it's CO2, water, chemicals, you know, we are really pushing hard as a corporation. A, it's the right thing to do. B, it's actually the right business decision.
Saves money.
Well, it does. It does. And also, what you can't measure is how your employees feel about you. Well, you can measure it, but I mean, it's tangible and it's real, and it's something we want our employees proud of us. And we want them to be able to say to their family and friends, you know, I work at Ford, and it's a great company. So that's important to us as well.
Lots of organizations, individuals are doing a lot, but scientists would say, and I'm sure you know them, would say it's not happening fast enough to stabilize the climate where it needs to get.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's you just look at the data, you know, and whether it's the polar ice caps or whether it's the drilling of the ice and capturing historical data. I mean, anything one looks at, you kind of end up in the same place.
Pine bark beetles devastating forests,
et cetera. Yeah, I mean, it's exactly.
Let's have our first audience question. Yes, sir.
Good evening, Mr. Ford. My name is Varian Bouzet. Very nice. I'm the director of the Oakland Institute of Automotive Technology, Incorporated. I put together a program to teach people about the electric vehicle program. It's a nonprofit. When they complete the nonprofit program...
Hope that isn't one of our engines. Excuse me.
And your question?
Basically, what I would like to do is try to reach you where I could get technical information from your engineering department.
Sure.
And the other part is building a prototype heavy-duty three-axle diesel tractor, converting it to electric.
Oh, that's very cool.
And
so perhaps you can connect with one
of
those people.
Yeah, Brad sure. Simmons here has worked for me, and I'll make sure Brad gets your info, and we'll definitely connect.
Right, because this is a door opening for high school graduates to have a job that's never been there before.
Well, congratulations. I think that's really cool. And, yes, we will follow up with you.
And we have some high school students here
thanks.
Tonight. Let's have our next audience question. Yes, sir.
I'm Don Sifkus from San Leandro and also from Sterling Heights, Michigan.
Oh, no kidding.
Yes.
When you say also, you mean originally from?
50% there, 50%
here.
Oh,
okay.
In keeping with your stated objective, making people's lives better, why can't Ford Motor Company manufacture E100 flex fuel engines where the mileage is optimized for ethanol and not gasoline, instead of making E85 engines where the optimization is for gasoline mileage? Brazil did something similar to this years ago, and today Brazil imports no crude oil. Zippo, nada, zero.
Yeah.
Doing this would eliminate the need for the Keystone XL pipeline and make the United States independent of imported crude oil much faster and at a fraction of the cost of the electric vehicle program.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We're a big player in Brazil, and we're part of that development of the Brazilian industry. And you're right. It all runs on basically sugarcane ethanol. There are huge government subsidies for that. They're enormous, and it's frankly unaffordable long-term for the Brazilian government. You know, we can do it. I mean, we're a big player in the Brazilian market and have been. And one of the things about ethanol, though, is it's hard, as you know, it's hard to transport. So, and there was a lot of, as I said earlier, a couple of years ago, there was a big discussion about cellulosic ethanol because nobody wants to do it with corn because then you get into the food versus, you know, fuel debate. But it's, you know, to manufacture it in the quantities that we would need would be an enormous undertaking. And if that happens, we will absolutely be there with the hardware, no question. But the problem is, as we sit here today, we can, you know, the electrification of our industry is something that we think is more commercially doable earlier. Now, would it be cheaper for us to do ethanol? Absolutely. Because the modification of an engine isn't a big deal, as you probably know. You know, it's some seals and a few other things, because ethanol tends to burn a little hotter than gasoline. So you have to change a few of the fittings and connections, but it's not a big deal. So if we really thought that this country was going down the ethanol highway, boy, would we be there. But we don't see any sign of that.
In fact,
we can't drive. I mean, one of the great frustrations we have as a manufacturer, people say, well, why don't you just do X? Well, the reality is we can do X, but if the rest of the country isn't going that way, we're going to have a bunch of X's made and nobody's buying them. So the smartest thing for us to do, which I believe, which is what we're doing, is to continue to invest in the technology for biofuels, for hydrogen, and for these other propulsion systems, compressed natural gas, so that if one of these actually breaks as a commercially viable entity, we'll be there. We don't want to be on the outside looking in saying, well, wow, how did that happen, and now what are we going to do? But as we sit here today, it's not, and we're not in charge of that. I mean, that's, you know, we're not a fuel provider.
Let's have our next audience question. Yes, sir.
Aloha, Mr. Ford. My name is Ro. I'm the CEO of Kuakoa from Hawaii. I just want to thank you for your leadership in all these areas on environmentalism. I also wanted to ask you to please come to Hawaii with your electric Ford Focus. We're not in one of the launch markets, but we're a perfect place because we have the infrastructure, we have the government support, we have the subsidies, and we have plug-ins. So if you can do anything about
and you have solar roofs,
yes, we do.
And you can't drive very far,
exactly,
to Hawaii, we will greet you with a luau.
It's not a tough sell to get me to Hawaii. I'll tell you that much. Thank you. And actually, you know, the way you raise a good point, because the way we are rolling out our electric focus is we've chosen some early markets like California that we think are going to be early adopters, and also, you know, some of the East Coast markets. Eventually, we'll be everywhere with them. But because, you know, it required a sort of a targeted launch, I was going to say a focus launch would be a, we actually chose California and New York City first. We will get to Hawaii with it, and thank you for that.
Let's have our next audience question for William Clay Ford, Jr.
A few weeks ago, Mitt Romney was campaigning for the presidential nomination in Michigan, and he said that the largest problem facing the American automobile industry is unionization. Do you agree with Mr. Romney's assessment, and how would you characterize Ford's relationship with the unions?
I don't agree with that, and I think we have a tremendous relationship with our union. We've accomplished a lot together. One of the things that I have always believed is that I don't look at our workers as union and salary. I look at them as Ford workers. We all work at Ford. We all have a stake in the company. And when I walk into our plants, you know, our workers don't say, you know, I'm union. They say, you know, I work at Ford and I love it. And a lot of them, I'm fourth generation. We have a ton of people in our plants that are second, third, fourth, even fifth generation. And they are they love what they do, and they're very proud of our company, and they want us to win. And an example I'll cite was, you know, during the horrible downturn that our whole industry went through, you know, over the last 5 years, our union was great in helping us get competitive again. I mean, we did they took control of the health care, which was a huge drag on us, in a VEBA, which they took. This new contract that we just signed last week, they did a number of things to ensure our competitiveness as a company going forward. But it's a relationship. It requires working on every day. You don't just show up every 4 years at a table and sit across from somebody you don't know and say, okay, you know, what do you want, and here's what we're going to give you. I mean, one of the things I'm most proud of in my career is the relationships that I have within the people, within our company, and most especially within our plants. And that's something I think that surprises people who don't know Ford. They probably assume that, you know, I'm the corporate type and that we have the union types and that we don't like each other.
When there was I believe there was an accident at River Rouge, one of your plants, a few years ago, and you went right down there.
Yeah, that was a bad day. That was a very bad day.
But a lot of CEOs wouldn't have done that.
Well, but yeah, in fact, the advice I got was generals don't go to the front. And I said, well, then bust me to private because I'm out of here. I'm going right there. And you know, to me, it was the only human thing to do. I very much think that I can only speak to our union, and our union works really well with us to make us competitive. And actually, you know, and if then were to say, and because people have asked, well, then how did it get so out of whack? Well, we gave it to them over the last 50 years. I mean, it wasn't as if they did it to us. I mean, it takes two to tango. And we together then shifted gears and said, all right, how do we make us more competitive? And we've done that.
Let's have our next audience question.
Hi, Tim Collins, and I'm the founder and president of Clean Speed Technologies. We're located down at NASA Ames near Mountain View. I was lucky that I have a great friend who's on my advisory board, Roy Chapin III.
Oh, and yeah, sure.
So I hung out a lot in Grosse Pointe.
Well, his dad was chairman of American Motors.
Yeah, I know that. Yeah. Yeah. And so Roy's been a big help to us. We developed electric.
And actually, that's his cousin is right there.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, well, we'll chat.
Let's have you your question.
Roy was here 2 days ago. So anyway,
let's have your question. Thanks.
Yeah, what we found in the R&D is that the electric vehicle system is really complicated. The pure system, we believe that there's a frontier, and it's between the hybrid and the electric. And so because of that, we think that it's just a wide open playing field. And we look at the auto industry as you would look at it in 1910 for the electric vehicles. And I think that there's just going to be many companies like Tesla and like our company that will be starting up, and some of them, of course, will be successful. So I guess my question to you, and, you know, you let a lot of engineers go in 2008, just like all the other automobile companies, is do you see the electric vehicles as a playing field? The, you know, the Focus has a power system developed, you know, outside. So I just wanted to know what your thinking was there.
Yeah, we actually think it's a core competency for us, and we are building a very large electric capability within Ford. But you're absolutely right. I mean, we certainly don't have, and I would never claim we did, you know, a monopoly on good ideas. I mean, a lot of the really cool stuff will happen elsewhere. We just have to be open-minded enough and nimble enough to accept that and to, you know, wherever there's a good idea or a new technology, be willing to adopt it. And I think you're seeing that with us. I mean, it's interesting. You know, our Sync, which we developed with Microsoft, we've made it an open platform. We have a lot of startups in the Valley developing apps for Sync rather than us trying to own it all. And that's very different behavior from a company like ours. I love what you're doing, and I love what a lot of the other companies are doing. And anything that can move us quicker towards, you know, where we'd all like to go, I'm all for it.
Are you shopping for any acquisitions, companies to buy up that you think that because you'd
like
to
grab their... You know, I don't think actually we want to buy companies. I think we want to be customers for good ideas. And the reason I say that is, you know, you buy a company and it's a snapshot in time. And all of a sudden, that company, what you thought you were buying, you know, is antiquated in 3 years, or the founder left, or the key scientist left, or they don't like working in a big company. And, you know, it could be any of those things. And so I think for us to be really as nimble as possible, we don't need to own, in fact, probably shouldn't own a lot of these companies. We should just be great customers for them and help them develop their technologies.
Next question, please.
Mr. Ford, I'd like to thank you for the values you've brought to the American auto industry. And you said you want to improve people's lives. And as a former taxi commissioner in San Francisco, I just want to thank you on behalf of San Francisco's taxi drivers, because we've converted about 85% of our taxi fleet to hybrid vehicles. 7 years ago, next month, we introduced the first fleet of hybrid taxis in America. It was a Ford Escape. It's been a tremendous success for us. So I don't really have a question. I just wanted to thank,
thank you
for your advocacy and for Ford.
That's very nice. Thank you. Thanks. No, thank you. Well, I really appreciate it. You know, it's interesting, too, because we weren't sure how hybrids would hold up in city driving, you know, because we're in New York as well. New York and San Francisco, you know, there's some pretty tough driving going on. You know, New York with the potholes and San Francisco with the hills. And so, but to our great delight, the hybrids have been proven to be very, very durable, which has been great, because actually that's helped translate for retail customers that durability. So thank you for that.
And the drivers love them because they cost them less gas. It was a real win-win situation.
Yeah, it's been great. But it was a leap of faith for San Francisco and for New York to do that, because it wasn't a no-brainer by any means, because they didn't know what they were really getting into.
And why don't more cities do it?
Cities are. They're actually doing that now. And a lot of it's a cost issue. It's just, you know, a lot of the city's fleets are just old. But when they're starting to renew them, you're starting to see hybrids are much more part of the equation.
Yeah, certainly save the drivers on gas. Yes, sir. Next question.
Mr. Ford, my name is Andrew Frankel. I joined you 50 years ago. Could I please have my gold watch?
Well, this isn't gold. I actually want to hang on to it, but thank you.
But seriously speaking, two very quick questions. One, were you a bit surprised that Rick Wagoner turned up saying, would you like to merge? And would you agree that your secret weapon is Lewis Booth?
Might explain who those people
are.
When
Rick Wagner, is that your first question? Yeah, the first question was I surprised when Rick Wagner, who was the CEO of General Motors, came to us about merging? It was during the dark days, and I grew up in an era where General Motors was the big, you know, the big gorilla in Detroit, and we were, you know, always trying to, you know, be a scrappy number two. And so, it was a bit surreal to have that conversation. I think it was the right decision not to. We couldn't have handled it. We were very fragile ourselves, and we were very much like General Motors. We didn't need, you know, you don't need Chevy trucks and Ford trucks. You don't need Camaros and Mustangs. You don't need, so, you know, really, if the goal would have been to preserve jobs, it wouldn't have happened, because there would have been a lot of slashing and burning. So we weren't the logical player to do it with them. You mentioned Lewis Booth, our chief financial officer. Yeah, he's been terrific. He used to run Ford of Europe. He used to I mean, he's run operations all around the Ford world, and it wasn't a natural for him to become a chief financial officer, but he's been a great one. So thank you for that.
Next audience question. Yes, sir.
Welcome, Bill. Giving away my age a little bit, this goes back before World War II. A friend of mine's grandmother had an electric car, and as a preteen, we would go back and forth on the long driveway. I'd like to think if this much time and development had been spent on electric cars against the internal combustion engine, we might have had them a little sooner.
There's no question about it. You raise a really interesting point. My great-grandfather's best friend was Thomas Edison, and together actually, if I could digress just for a second, because it's kind of cool.
We love these stories.
There was a group that called themselves the Vagabonds, and it was Harvey Firestone, Henry Ford, Thomas Edison, the naturalist John Burroughs, and whoever the president at the time. And they would go camping, and there were some great stories that came out. My grandmother told me that before she died that she got invited. It was rare that they invited wives, but they invited. They went along and. She said it was kind of neat because Edison would string up portable electric lights at camp, and he was pretty well deaf, so all the pictures you see was Henry sort of screaming in his ear. But Edison was very vain about it, so he didn't want any pictures taken because he had a hearing aid. But so she was telling this one story. They pulled up at this general store. They were in northern Maine, in the middle of nowhere, and. So she went in with a guide, and the guide looks out the window and said, well, I recognize those people. And said, yeah, you know, that's Harvey Firestone, that's Henry Ford, that's Thomas Edison, that's President Harding. And he turned, the fellow who ran the general store turned to the guide and said, right, and who are you, Jesus Christ? But you're absolutely right. They did develop the electric vehicle, and they were running around on electricity, you know, back 100 years ago.
The Detroit Electric, right? It was a ladies' car.
But here's the thing. Gasoline was a lot cheaper. Fuel, you know, they discovered oil in Texas, and all of a sudden, you know, gasoline was, you know, and it wasn't clear. I mean, it was either going to be steam or electric that was going to power the world at that point. And all of a sudden, you know, gasoline was discovered in big quantities, or oil was, and then it became the fuel for aviation, for boats, and for cars. And you know, I often wonder what would have happened, you know, had that. But it was the cheapest option.
1935, my first airplane flight was in a Ford Trimotor, so maybe there is a connection there with Boeing. But question I have, what training programs have you developed for people that don't have the skills, need to acquire them, particularly returning veterans?
We actually work very closely with the veterans group, and we do have training programs, both technical and also with the UAW. And it's you know, our relationship with the veterans group is something that's kind of a highlight of ours. We also do a lot, in addition to that, we do a lot of outfitting vehicles for veterans that come back that are handicapped. So, you know, and we can't do enough for them, obviously.
Let's have our next audience question. Yes, sir.
When will we be able to buy a car from Ford that drives itself?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Now, I hope we never see that. I love to drive. Now, having said that, you know, to me, it's kind of a blast to drive. But a lot of people, you know, particularly in urban areas, would like, so we are working on autonomous cars, as are others. I mean, it's certainly, you know, Google's. I spoke at the TED conference this last year, talked about global gridlock, and you know, Google was there demonstrating a driverless vehicle. It's very cool. We have one. I think GM does. Others probably do as well. What's the time frame? I can't tell you that because you think of the safety issues, the huge logistical issues in terms of traffic flows and red lights and, you know, pedestrians and all those things that are going to have to be factored in. And right now it's just a very cool demo thing. And it's still not perfect, but technology is coming along fast. And, you know, I'd be surprised if, certainly in my driving lifetime, if we didn't have them on the road. I can't give you a precise timing because I just don't know. And we're going to have a lot of discussions around those other issues that I outlined before they really are ready for for everyday people to have them. But, you know, it's interesting. I get to see kind of all kinds of cool new stuff, some of which, you know, makes sense. And you'd be amazed at how many people have come to me lately, inventors with flying cars.
So you could get back in the aviation business.
Yeah, but there's one, and they work. And it's actually kind of, you know, because, I mean, I've prototypes work where they fold the wings and they stow in the trunk. And
have you gotten in one yet?
No. But there's one other sort of small point that, you know, that kind of I think is a limiting factor is you have to have a pilot's license to have one.
Yeah.
You have to take off and land at airports. And so kind of, you know, at that point, what's the purpose? But actually, I love the thought process that goes into it. And whether it's flying cars or autonomous vehicles, I mean, we are really entering an age where all this is possible and technology is really going to be delivering it. Then we'll have to use common sense to say what really makes sense here and what kind of technology is going to make our lives better and what kind of technology is going to make our lives more complex and more difficult. And I think that's where the judgment starts to come in.
People often think that the auto companies and the oil companies are pretty close together. Are they blocking the move toward electricity, which would kind of
doesn't really
displace?
Matter. It's happening. I mean, it's interesting. I've heard that. We're not aligned with anybody and can't be. I mean, whether it's like biofuels or whether it's compressed natural gas. I mean, I won't go through the litany again of fuels. But we have to be completely agnostic about fuel providers other than we would like ubiquity of fueling, whatever that fueling is, whether it's charging or ethanol or gasoline, diesel, whatever it is. Our customers have to be able to get it, and they have to be able to get it in a way that makes them confident because if they have to worry about where am I going to fuel up, people don't want to be there, and they shouldn't be there. So, it's going to happen.
We've come to the end. I just want to ask you sort of a legacy question. You have youngish children, as do others.
Two of them are here
yes.
tonight. Yep.
So,
and they live in this city. and I'm very envious of the fact they live in this city.
And my son is here as well. So, talk about our generation is handing off to the next generation, both in terms of the environmental situation as the financial situation. You talked about not so much.
Well, we have huge problems facing us, but I also believe we have huge opportunities ahead of us. And I am no more pessimistic today than I was 10, 20 years ago. And in fact, I think I'm more optimistic because there's also a generation of problem solvers. I mean, if you think back to what an environmentalist meant when you and I were growing up, it meant you were against everything because that's all you could be. You were out protesting. You were plugging up pipes chemical factories, and you were, basically trying to limit yourself in a way that most people couldn't do or didn't want to do, and there was no way out other than just stopping everything and being against everything. But I think there's a generation now that wants to solve problems and wants to bring, technology to bear to solve those problems. And so I'm actually really hopeful that this next generation is going to deliver. We kind of screwed up the world. I'm actually hopeful that, and I think this next generation is going to be the one that's going to save us. And I hope I'm around long enough to see it, because I'm actually very excited and optimistic that as big as the problems that we face are, as poor as the legacy that some of the prior generations, including ours, has left, I think this generation is they have the get up and go to solve it, and they're going to have the tools to make a big dent in it. And I'm looking forward to it.
Our thanks to been listening to William Clay Ford, Jr., Executive Chairman of Ford Motor Company at Climate One at the Commonwealth Club. A complete interview is available in the iTunes Store. This podcast, a free podcast. I'm Greg Dalton. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you very
much. That was fun. Thanks.